introduce next up Dr. Jody Sherman. She's an associate professor of anesthesiology and epidemiology at the Yale School of Medicine and Yale School of Public Health. She'll be speaking to us about the environmental impact of anesthetic gases. Thank you so much, Jody.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for this invitation. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. So how I got interested in the topic actually probably pretty much started as a resident when it was so much fun to do anesthesia, and I was really excited by my career choice, but I was really rather overwhelmed, as I think probably everyone in this room is, by the amount of stuff that we're using and the amount of stuff that we waste and throw away, and wondering what that is doing to public health, to environmental health, and also how this stuff is made and manufactured and those natural resources and how that is impacting public health. And there was really no information on it. So that really started my journey of collaborating with environmental engineers and other types of professionals to try and understand the impact of our practice. So today, what I'd like to cover is the relationship between pollution and public health, what we know so far. Defined life cycle assessment, which is the engineering tool that helps us quantify emissions. To summarize key inhaled anesthetic pollution findings and to identify opportunities for practice improvement. I have no relationships with industry, and for people who tweet or Twitter, my handle is at greeningdoc, and there's some suggested hashtags here. I don't know if we have a specific one for MPOG, but for the anesthesia meeting, it's ASA 2019. So why sustainability? Quite simply, we live in a finite world, and human health is dependent on environmental health. That's the bottom line. We know from ice core sampling and from the poles and carbon dating, we can now go back actually 850,000 years, that the carbon dioxide quantities in the atmosphere ranged between 188 to 280 parts per million up until most recently. In the Industrial Revolution, we started burning fossil fuels, and we see a rapid rise of CO2 accumulating in the atmosphere. We are now at 413 parts per million, which is the highest known in as far back as we can go. And the rate of change is really alarming, and this is correlated with increase in global temperatures. And this has now been called an emergency. Climate change has been called a medical emergency, starting with the Lancet Commission on Health and Climate Change. This has now been repeated by the World Health Organization, the UN, and most recently 7,000 higher education institutions across six continents this past year have come along with the same statement. Pollution is a leading cause of death of non-communicable disease and death. 9 million premature deaths annually across the globe, or 16% of all global deaths are attributed to pollution. So I'm going to be talking a lot about climate change, but obviously there's other types of pollutants of concern, most notably air pollution. And air pollution and climate change are closely linked because they're most tightly associated with the burning of fossil fuels. And this is costing our economy trillions of dollars globally. And there is a return on investment in preventing pollution. And so, sorry about that. The effects, the health effects of climate change are actually being felt already today with both more extreme heat days affecting COP exacerbation, emergency room emissions, cardiovascular exacerbations, severe weather events. We're feeling this certainly in the US. Hurricanes Irene, Sandy affected us in Connecticut. Absolutely. Hurricane Harvey in Texas. The historic wildfires in California, not only affecting air quality and exacerbations of health, but also affecting our ability to deliver health care in our infrastructure. And there's migration happening. Most of the global population lives along the coast, and so as sea level rises, mass migration is becoming more of an issue. And so there's a lot of information here, but the short story is that we are already feeling the health effects, and it's mostly being felt by poorer countries, but we certainly feel it here in the US. So the World Health Organization Director General, this was already our prior Director General, so this is not new information, has said climate change will be the defining issue for health systems in the 21st century. Health professionals have the knowledge, cultural authority, and responsibility to protect health from climate change. Well, we don't have enough knowledge yet. That's why I personally speak on this issue. But not only do we have a responsibility overall in trying to prevent pollution, but also within healthcare itself. And last year, importantly, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had a special report. So the Paris Agreement was to try and bring the global community around a commitment to limit temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the 21st century. And basically, this report said that that's not really good enough to try and mitigate catastrophic response to health and global civilization, and that we need to aim for 1.5 degrees. And so business as usual is going to, by the end of the century, result in average global temperatures rising between 4.1, 4.8 degrees Celsius. This is where our current commitments bring us to. Policies our aspirations are still not good enough, and even 2 degrees centigrade limit of warming, our current commitments are not even there yet. So this report very notably stated that emissions need to fall by 45% by 2030 and reach net zero by 2050. So you've heard a lot of news that we're all going to die if, you know, we don't get to net zero within 11 years or make a big difference within 11 years. That's not what it means. What it means is to be able to mitigate the amount of harm that we're going to see over this century and to allow us time to adapt and to improve global society. So this time is really critical. And so the IPCC co-chair has said the next few years are probably the most important in all of human history. And these are big statements, but I am repeating them because I agree with these statements. And so what is life cycle assessment? This is an engineering tool. So it's not just the stuff that we throw away. Is paper better than plastic bag? Is cloth diaper better than disposable diapers? And, you know, we see the amount of stuff we throw in the trash, but it's not as simple as that, right? So there's also natural resource or raw material extraction, manufacturing of those materials, packaging, transportation, utilization, disposal. So it's all the life phases. Environmental emissions occur at every single stage, and where the impacts are bigger are not always intuitive, and so we really need to look at the whole picture in order to inform decision making. And we need to consider multiple impacts. I'm talking quite heavily about greenhouse gas emissions. There are obviously other types of pollutants of concern. And so one of the things that we had done, my research partner, Dr. Matt Eckelman from Northeastern University, is tried to quantify, this is using an economic input output LCA model, the impacts of the entire U.S. health sector over time. The initial study was done by Chung and Meltzer at University of Chicago in 2009, but we did several additions to that. Firstly, we looked over time. And notably what we found, and this was the most up-to-date economic data at the time, that if the U.S. health sector were a country itself, it would rank 13th in the world for greenhouse gas emissions. So 10% of our nation's greenhouse gas emissions come from healthcare. We also looked at other environmental emissions, and air pollution was a big one, where nearly 10% also of our nation's air pollutants, criteria air pollutants. And all damages from standard pollution criteria showed an estimated disease burden of 614 disability-adjusted life years lost annually, mostly from air pollution and climate change. And this was actually found to be similar in magnitude to medical deaths, deaths due to medical errors, as first reported by the Institute of Medicine back in 1999. Now, the actuaries in the IOM report calculated an average loss of 10 years of life lost annually from these medical errors, so that puts us in the same order of magnitude as that from dailies lost from pollution. And so we're trying to say that pollution prevention is a new patient safety movement, that we tend to not think about public health, particularly as anesthesia providers. We're obviously taking care of the patient right in front of us, but we have to also think that all of the community is our patient as well. And so how we think about patient safety, we're trying to say that pollution prevention is really part of this. And so this will be coming out next month in The Lancet, the global healthcare sector greenhouse gas emissions. Globally, healthcare is responsible for 4.6% of greenhouse gas emissions. This is huge. And clearly the United States is an outlier. The left, this is a function of GDP per capita, and the bubble width indicates the proportion of national health spending on healthcare. And on the right, we're looking at over time. So the U.S. is an outlier, but this is also a global issue. We're not unique in that. And so this was a report from the Sustainable Development Unit, which is affiliated with the National Health Service in the U.K., there are several things I like about this presentation of the data. Firstly, the major categories of greenhouse gas emissions. Travel, building and energy, our healthcare facilities are the second largest energy intensive type buildings. And then procurement, or all the devices that we're using, and then drugs. This is about two-thirds of healthcare's footprint. So this is the stuff that we have control over as health providers. And then, interestingly, based on our work, which I'm about to show you, they estimated what their health sector footprint is from inhaled anesthetics. The prior data I showed you did not include inhaled anesthetics because the economic modeling does not take into account that these are potent greenhouse gases. And so what they found was 2.5% of the UK health sector emissions is coming from inhaled anesthetics. Now, they're heavy in nitrous use. We'll talk more about that. The other interesting finding is that 5% of a healthcare organization's footprint comes from anesthetic gases. These are huge numbers, and these numbers have been corroborated by other case reports here in the U.S. And so really what we're trying to say is extend what we mean by quality improvement. So the triple aim, deliver the maximum health gain or experience of care, minimal cost, while adding value at every opportunity for the most people. And so the value equation has to include environmental and social impacts, so minimizing the environmental impacts and the social harm. And so we recently published an article in JAMA that gets into further detail on this, and this is really the argument that we're trying to make. And so what happens to inhaled anesthetics? When I was a resident, I used to think the scavenging system somehow innocuously scrubbed and did something and made these substances inert. And Susan Ryan from the University of California in San Francisco really brought to light that the importance of the fact that we're just venting these gases off our hospital rooftops. There's very little metabolism that occurs. Some of them are very destructive to the ozone layer. They're potent greenhouse gases, and nowhere in the world are their emissions currently controlled. And so just very briefly, while we're not getting into the ozone impacts, the ozone layer here is to protect us from ultraviolet radiation, so when we destroy that, we leave ourselves more prone to things like skin cancer. The greenhouse gas effect, actually, we need greenhouse gases to keep our planet warm and support life, but what's happening is we're trapping more energy, more heat than is being reflected back out. So this is where our inhaled anesthetics are accumulating. And so what we did, Susan Ryan was the first to do this, we turned this into a smartphone app, a free smartphone app, which I invite you all to look at. And that is essentially looking at, the effects of fresh gas flow rates per MAC hour for each of these drugs. And some things that really note here, and this is expressed as miles driven equivalent for an hour of anesthetic. And some things to note here is that obviously the higher your fresh gas flow rate, the higher your mileage, or the higher the amount of emissions you're producing. And also the other thing to note is that choice of drug matters. And sorry about that. So desflurane here is an outlier, and nitrous oxide is also an outlier. And since we can't do a full MAC of nitrous oxide, the nitrous data is presented as a 0.6 MAC versus the others being a full MAC. And so if you wanted to understand the additive effect, you take 0.4 of these and add it to this. And so this begged the question, well, what about the life cycle? I mean, this is what happens when you throw the drug away, the direct global warming potential in the atmosphere. So we asked, what about the entire life cycle? And furthermore, what about an alternative like propofol? And so some things that really stand out in this graph. So firstly, this is assuming 1 liter fresh gas flow for 1 hour for desflurane and isoflurane, and it assumes 2 liters fresh gas flow for SIVO and 100 milligrams per kilo per hour of propofol. And so the thing to notice here is that you can't even see propofol. So in fact, propofol, the greenhouse gas emissions were 4 orders of magnitude less than the inhaled anesthetic. So this included the energy to run the pump. This included the plastic tubing and syringes, which are common questions that I get asked. So all the packaging and the energy involved in the life cycle is included here. My apologies. The other things to notice here is that the vast majority of the inhaled anesthetic footprint is coming from what's the waste phase. That blue little part is the other phases in manufacturing, transportation, packaging. And desflurane is, again, an outlier. So if you just look at the light pink compared to ISO and SIVO, desflurane is about 20 times the impact. And if you add nitrous on at 0.6 MAC, it makes everything larger, even if you're using ISO and SIVO. And the nitrous here is twice as big because that's assuming 2 liters. And so the next logical question we ask are, what about non-inhaled anesthetics? And so this was an observational trial funded by the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation, and I'm proud to say, based on the last 2 lectures, that we absolutely did write out our methods, and they were approved by the funding agency as well as our IRB and clearly stated. The things that stand out here are our hypothesis was that any anesthetic that used inhaled gases was going to have a significantly higher footprint than any other approach, and that's what we found. So the orange here is inhaled anesthetic, and specifically sevoflurane. We no longer have desflurane at our institution. If this were desflurane, it would be 20 times higher. And so another question I get, well, but it's not just about the greenhouse gas emissions. What about all the propofol? What's that? It's ecotoxic. We assume that propofol is incinerated, which is recommended by the manufacturer, but nonetheless, this is a study that by looking at essentially surveying all different types of experts and to rank their impact concerns. So the concern about propofol being a water toxicant is an important one, but just ranking concerns of toxicity. In the short term, air pollution is the greatest concern, short meaning 0 to 10 years. Medium and long term, climate change is ranked number one. So this was an interesting study done by a colleague, an environmental engineer now at NYU, who looked at the environmental footprint of different types of surgical approaches to the same procedure. So whereas, you know, we did the same thing with inhaled anesthetics, you know, if you had your choice of approach to anesthesia, what would be the better approach? From an environmental perspective. And that's what she did here, looking at different approaches to hysterectomy. The things to notice here is the light purple. What that is that the inhaled anesthetic. So the simpler approaches, the open abdominal or vagus-assisted inhaled anesthetics are about two-thirds of the footprint. This included all the reusable instruments, disposable instruments, linens, the energy to run the HVAC system, and all the equipment in the operating room. And then the more intensive procedures, resource-intensive procedures, laparoscopic, robotic, inhaled anesthetics were about one-third the total footprint of the procedure. The wide error bars here are because a couple of these cases actually use propofol. None of these cases use desflurane. And so another colleague looked at all of perioperative services in 3 hospitals in 3 countries, the first one being the U.S., the second one being Canada, and the third one being the U.K., and so this is essentially replicating similar things in that if you look at all of the equipment and the HVAC systems, the energy and the inhaled anesthetics for all of perioperative services over a year's period, half to two-thirds of that footprint is coming from inhaled anesthetics. This is huge. And the difference in the third institution here in the UK is that they don't use desflurane. Now, one thing to note here is that none of these institutions use nitrous oxide, which would have made this data look even more weighted toward the footprint of inhaled anesthetics. This has begged a question, do we even need desflurane? Now, obviously, patients can wake up faster with desflurane. That's true for cases, particularly under 90 minutes. Greater than 110 minutes, we start seeing comparable wake-up times. And of note, in this original research, researchers kept patients on one MAC, full MAC, until the end of the case, which is not how we practice. In reality, we titrate our drugs down. And so there's this question, well, you know, what about the cost implications, faster wake up, meaning more money? That really depends on your payer mix, your patient volume. Do you have a line of patients to get out the door? Can you really squeeze in another patient? So Yale New Haven Health System was the first in the world to get rid of desmarine or get rid of any drug based on environmental grounds. So we eliminated it from our formulary in 2013, saved approximately 186,000 kilograms of carbon dioxide emissions annually, or the equivalent of 450,000 miles driven in 1 year. We noted our sevoflurane use went up slightly, isoflurane no change. We assumed no difference in TEVA and regional approaches. And across our, this is just for our flagship institution, but those calculations, but we eliminated across our health system and saved $1.2 million annually by getting rid of the drug and the vaporizers because we were charged to rent them as well. University of Utah also did a similar thing, but for different reasons. They had a cash challenge that if they could truly save up to $300,000, that they could get 50% of that back. And so they had a big push by the chair there, Grand Rounds, a challenge to the department. They were able to show that they saved $300,000 in acquisitions costs by reducing the use of desmarine, where we, by declaration, just got rid of the drug. And they saved the equivalent of driving 5.4 million miles. And that institution, they actually substituted with isoflurane, and they showed they didn't increase their turnover times, or I think they said that they increased wake-up time by something like 1 or 2 minutes, which is probably not significant. They didn't increase their PACU times. Propofol use didn't go up, and as I said, they used increase in isoflurane use. Unfortunately, the behavior change didn't stick. Within a year, people were back to the usual practices. University of Wisconsin recently published an article that they did an education campaign. They actually put these informative stickers on their vaporizers at the point of decision making. They had this QC code where you could scan and get more information, read some articles while you're sitting there taking care of your patient. Basically to try and discourage use of desmarine, encourage more use of sevoflurane. Now they tried to make this sticker look pretty as if this was, you know, great for the environment to use sevoflurane. It's not that it's great for the environment, it's that it's less bad. But nonetheless, the campaign really worked, not only just discouraging use of desmarine, but also nitrous oxide. They saved 2.8 million kilograms of carbon dioxide in a year, or the equivalent of 7 million miles driven, saved $300,000 in acquisition costs, and their behavior changes sticking. University of British Columbia, 7 hospitals, similar campaign. Their desmarine use is down, being replaced by sevoflurane. Between 2012 and 2018, they saved nearly 9 million kilograms of CO2, carbon dioxide emissions, or 66% reduction, the equivalent of getting 1,700 cars off the road. University of Oregon has taken a step further, and this is getting us closer to where we're, what we want to do with MPOG, what we've already started doing with MPOG, and they're doing provider performance reports. And so basically showing people not only their the drugs that they're using compared to their peers, what their carbon dioxide emissions equivalents are, and equivalent miles driven, and what they're finding is that sevoflurane is replacing desmarine, and that they're saving money. So between 2016 and 2018, they saved nearly 5 million kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalents, or 12 million miles driven, and saved over $600,000 annually. And again, no difference in, and they look at out-of-room times and PACU times, and no difference. And so I apologize as for those in the back, it's probably a little hard to read. This is from Kaiser Permanente, which is the largest non-governmental health system in the U.S. They have a very robust sustainability division, and some of the things I've found is that inhaled anesthetics account for 3% of their organizational footprint. So this is overall their entire organization, not even just a single facility. So this is already... essentially saying the similar things to what they found with the UK Sustainable Development Report. And so we actually also worked with their anesthesia managers Excuse me. And so what we're seeing over time here, this is from Northern California region, where they serve more than 3 million patients annually, that between 2014 and 2017, they've achieved a 40% reduction of their greenhouse gas emissions just by reducing the use of death swine. They're actually removing it from the entire health system in Northern California. Southern California is now working on it, so this work is spreading. But that this blue here is nitrous oxide, so that's a whole other thing to tackle here. It's not as simple as just getting rid of the death swine vaporizer, right? We have to also influence behavior change. And so scaling up practice improvement, the role of sustainability metrics. So we talked about removing the offensive options, creating barriers, like some barriers include locking up the vaporizer to try and discourage its use, using financial incentives, educational campaigns, point of care information, which there's a long history of in terms of using financial data to try and influence behavior change, for example, laboratory test ordering. Now we're talking about adding greenhouse gas emissions to that as well, feedback reports. And the next step would even be financial penalties or pay for performance or carbon taxes. And so I'm very excited to be working with MPOG. We've created the first sustainability metric, which now has the ability to reach millions more patient care opportunities. And so this metric was decided that we would start at 3 liters fresh gas flow to try and give some feedback on fresh gas flow as a starting point, because this is a more achievable metric to start with than going after the greenhouse gas emissions. Inclusion criteria, inhaled anesthetics greater than 30 minutes from placement of the airway device to its removal. Exclusion cases that did not use inhaled anesthetics where the maintenance period is less than 30 minutes, or cases where significant quantities of the fresh gas flow values are manually entered, which we know are not accurate. And these are some results from my own institution. Our overall performance is at 73%, so we've got some room to go, but not too far off from how the other institutions are doing, the goal being 90% success rate. And so some are doing well, some not doing so well. These are the anonymized institutional performances. We're pretty happy for a number of reasons, including that we think that this metric gives us something to aim for, but is not too far out of reach. And there is some history of anesthesia information management system alerts. So this work by NARE published in 2013. Work was actually done in 2010. Real-time alerts that if fresh gas flows exceeded 1 liter per minute, now remember we set our goal to 3 liters, 1 liter per minute, or if it's SIVO after 2 MAC hours, then the alert would go on to increase to 2 liters. And they showed a mean fresh gas flow reduction from 2.1 to 1.59 liters per minute. So their starting point is a little unclear, but we looked at some AQI data several years ago now that showed nationally the average fresh gas flow rate was 5 liters per minute, which sounds really high. I don't know about your experience, but when I first started my institution, I would go into a room and frequently I would see air at 3 liters and O2 at 2 liters. And when you look at the inspired concentration monitor, that gives you around 50%. So I think there's something that we like about those numbers. After beating people about fresh gas flow rates, we're down to 2 liters, but 2 liters for everything, whether or not that's even required. So there's a lot of room to improve just on fresh gas flows. So what's next for sustainability metrics? Again, fresh gas flow alerts. Next is adding the greenhouse gas emissions for the inhaled drugs. We've also published data on emissions for intravenous drugs. This is also in the free smartphone app, so you can see. What about non-greenhouse gas emissions? We can certainly do that. And drug waste is a big thing that I'm interested in working on. 50 to 80% of our intravenous drugs are routinely thrown out. There is opportunity to integrate procurement and electronic health record data, which is something we're working on at Yale, so we can do a better job of driving down the ability to do performance reports on waste. And then overdosing, which is, I think, quite common. Very difficult to try and describe, but I think there is opportunity there. And again, we eventually would like to see pay for performance accountability. Just one quick note on waste anesthetic gas capture and treatment. This technology does exist. There are these charcoal filters. They're actually designed for sites that do not have good scavenging systems. And when you toss them in the trash, basically they condense the volatiles into liquid form. You throw them out, and then they quickly evaporate. They don't really do much for nitrous oxide. So they don't really work. There are gas capturing systems. This is an example of one. The idea is that the drug can eventually be recycled and sold for reuse. That has not been approved yet anywhere in the world, but that is what they're hoping for. So presently, there's a storage issue, and it only works for volatiles. There is gas destruction technology. This is pretty much for nitrous oxide only. This is becoming very common in Europe, and particularly in Sweden, where 100% of their labor and delivery facilities have this installed on their rooftops, although there is some question about the efficiency of this technology. And so we've actually started, through the ASA, a 2020 challenge: reduce your facility inhaled anesthetic greenhouse gas emissions by 50%. MPOG can help with this. We believe this is very achievable, both by reducing fresh gas oil rates and also by different choices of drugs. But the number one thing we are recommending is going for lowest fresh gas flows, avoiding high-impact inhaled anesthetics when it is safe to do so, so desflurane nitrous oxide reduction, considering intravenous and regional techniques when it is safe to do so, and then invest in trapping or destruction technology. And this is coming from the ASA Environmental Task Force that I co-chair. And so finally, I thank everyone here. And just to quote the World Health Organization, health professionals have a duty to care for current and future generations. And to quote the ASA mission, we're about advancing the practice and securing the future. So while we don't typically think about public health in the domain of what we do as anesthesiologists, I think it's all of our responsibility. So thank you very much.
I think we've got time for just a few moments of questions. We're about 10 minutes behind due to no one's fault, but we'll have Eric come up at 9:45. A couple minutes of questions from the audience. Hi, I'm an audience member. So, Nomura and Jody, thank you so much. This is, when we thought about MPOG 10 years ago, we had never imagined we could potentially have an environmental impact. So this is such inspiring work. Tips that you have, what got people screaming at you in your office? Because we're not going to have the sustainability metric available to every single member of MPOG. You'll see your facility numbers, where your benchmark. What are some of the tips and tricks that you have found to be helpful to get human change related to? No, I love nitrous. So for the record, I love nitrous. I love ISO. I was trained by a guy who loves nitrous and ISO. He hates desflurane. Yeah, we don't. I couldn't find desflurane if my life depended on my OR or my patient's life depended on it. What are the tips and tricks to go from that a nitrous life to a non-nitrous life?
Well, as somebody who hasn't used nitrous in over a decade, except for maybe one or two circumstances where we lost our IV on induction, or I had to at least do some modest analgesic and keep my patient breathing. It's kind of like, how do you become a vegetarian when you love meat? There has to be a mental switch. You have to believe that there's a reason to do it. So for vegetarianism, it could be because of health issues, it could be because of ethical treatment of animals, and it could be because of environmental protection, because industrial agriculture, especially raising meat, is a problem. In terms of nitrous oxide, I do 95% TEVA, and when the drapes come down, my patients wake up, and they're pretty clear-headed, and the residents get to see. I think no matter what anesthesia approach you use, the finesse and nuance of what we do as clinicians is to be able to time our wake-ups. And so it doesn't matter what approach you use. So I would just challenge you to flip a mental switch in terms of, for a while our pediatric anesthesiologists actually stopped using nitrous oxide for their inductions, because what is the value of the second gas effect? Is it really clinically significant Does it really make a difference in clinical practice? This business of turning nitrous oxide on at the end of the case to time your wake up better, forgive me for saying this, I think it's a lazy person's approach because it's not necessary. It really isn't. So I think we just need to care. I mean, part of why I'm trying to make the argument here is that pollution is a big issue. Every single time we take care of a patient, actually, it causes me some angst because even when I'm doing the best minimal use of resources and taking care of my patient, I'm harming somebody else every single time. I'm always thinking about that. So for me, if I'm thinking I'm going to cause more harm if I use this one drug, it's not hard for me to switch. Thank you for the question.
Hi, Ben Cloyd from the University of Michigan. Great talk, thank you. First off, thank you for doing all this. It's fantastic. My question is, so at the university levels, we frequently have even more aggressive and higher targets at neutralizing, say, carbon emissions. Like, for example, the University of Michigan, I don't know exactly what it is, but I think it's carbon neutral by 2025, 2030, somewhere in that line, so sooner. And that, I'm wondering, it seems like at Yale, you must have a significant amount of institutional support. Where did you go to get help? How did that work out? You know, where did you see, did you get institutional help at a higher level, or was it more like a department-driven thing? I was wondering along those lines.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Yes, many universities, if not the majority of them, have very strong sustainability plans, Yale University being one of them. And similarly, our health system is community-based. It is affiliated, but it is a completely different administration. But what we do is we have a robust sustainability group at our hospital, and we collaborate and share resources and information with our university. We're actually trying to launch a joint center now on healthcare sustainability. But in terms of answering your question, how do you get the resources? Most of this comes from the ground up. It comes from some caring individuals who start a green team. Honestly, it's usually started by nurses who want to recycle plastics. And it takes all different kinds, all different professionals to get this going. In terms of making the change in my own department, it was not easy. There was a lot of resistance. Making the business case is a really good one. So, you know, getting rid of dysphane for on environmental grounds is an easy one. But, you know, trying to make this a case that this is part of quality improvement. This is the next generation of quality improvement, which is protecting public health at the same time we're protecting our patients. Thank you.
Kate Hagen, I'm from MD Anderson. What have you seen as far as plastic waste? My institution has recently gone towards using disposable laryngoscopes, so we're throwing away over 100 plastic laryngoscopes every single day. And this was prompted in response to CMS visits and concerns about sterilization afterwards.
Yeah.
And it seems as though this is not a good trend.
Right. I've published two articles on the last year and also one in the APSF newsletter. The short story is that we've done the life cycle costing and life cycle assessment of reusable versus disposables. Reusables are definitely better from an environmental perspective and a cost perspective. At our own institution, you have to do your own data. But if you look past the silo across the entire institution, you know, the break-even point is something like you need to get something like 7 uses out of a blade or, you know, 5 uses out of a handle to break-even cost disposable versus reusable. They're rated for 4,000 uses. So people say they get lost and so go to disposables. If you can't get that number of uses before you lose your equipment, then you need to retrain your staff. It doesn't mean go to disposables. But in terms of CMS, what they're doing is saying you have a choice. They're reinterpreting some foggy guidelines, which we're trying to address through the ASA. But those foggy guidelines are now allowing manufacturers to say the level of risk is intermediate, when in fact, for the tongue blade, it's an intermediate risk. For the handle, it has been considered low risk for a very long time, meaning you can just clean it with your cloth, chemical cloth in the OR. So CMS is now saying, or not CMS, it's the Joint Commission, it's the oversight bodies coming in suddenly interested in this topic, saying, well, you must consider this intermediate risk, meaning your choices are go to disposable or send it down to your central sterilization supply for handling. This was all part of our cost analysis. If you email me, or you can either look PubMed or email me, I'm happy to send you the articles. But so your institution has the choice: go to, you know, to either go to a central sterilization supply for high level disinfection or throw them away. If you do the cost analysis, you can push the back. We had switched to disposals in our own institution. That's why we did the studies. and we quickly switched back. We saved our institution, you know, over close to $1 million by making that across our, you know. So the cost argument is there, but if you have to not trust the data that you're getting, because Central Sterilization Supplies is going to use their own silo and cost, so you have to look across silos. And in terms of workload, it was like an additional 1% workload. Our CSS department handles 12,000 instruments a day. We're talking 167 handles, 167 blades a day in our institution on average. Thank you for the question. I know we're way over. I appreciate the time.